Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime reporter and Washington, D.C. Special Police Officer. Today, I'm honored to have the Chief of Patrol for the NYPD, Rodney Harrison, joining us.
It was a very scary moment in my life, especially seeing your partner shot, especially when he tells you that he's having trouble breathing. It was a night that I'll never forget.
He oversees all 8 patrol boroughs of the NYPD and has 17,000 officers on his command. Not to mention, he's been an instrumental part of the new NYPD program that's taking a fresh look at what it means to work closely with local communities throughout the neighborhood policing project.
One of the best things you could do in law enforcement is communicate, talk to one another, share each other's concerns and ideas.
Today, we'll dig into all of that and much more. Chief, welcome. So good to have you here.
Tom, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure, and it's been a great journey being part of this organization. It really has.
NYPD is in law enforcement. This is one of the biggest departments in the world.
Yeah, it is. 36,000 members of service that are doing their best work to try to keep this great city safe. And we have a lot more to do, but I'm very blessed to be in this position and to just see some of the great work that's being done throughout the city.
What was the path that led you into law enforcement?
So there wasn't necessarily a path. I really never had any aspirations in being in law enforcement.
No?
I was struggling in school. Dad said he's not going to pay for college anymore, and he offered me this opportunity to join the Cadet Corps. The Cadet Corps is it's like an internship within NYPD. It helps pay for your school, and once you're done, you have an opportunity to come into the police department once you graduate. So I was against it at first, but I did want to pursuing my dream, which was, you know, get my degree. And I started doing the internship and working at a precinct in Bayside, Queens, 111. And I just saw some of the great work that the police officers were doing, and how they were able to help people and how they were to give back. And, growing up in Jamaica, Queens, I've had bad experience with police officers. But once I joined this Cadet Corps, I saw the human side of the police officers and some of the hard work that they put into the day-to-day journey of keeping their community safe.
What were some of the negative interactions you had as a young person with the police?
So there were times where I might have been at a location where maybe I didn't realize at the time I shouldn't have been there, where, you know, officers might have stopped me and my friends and might have...
When you weren't doing anything
when
wrong.
When I wasn't doing anything wrong. And maybe, you know, they might have put their foot up my behind just to make sure I got off the corner. And might have talked a little rough at the time, you know, me being a young male. Mm-hmm. I've been stopped in my vehicle and my cars might have been searched, but... Once again, is now that I'm in this line of work, I often see that, you know, sometimes there is reasons why, you know, cops may have to stop a car. Maybe there's information that they attain that may be the reason why they may have to search a car, things of that nature. So at the time, I might have been a little naive, but I wasn't necessarily so enthusiastic about about the law enforcement.
What was your rookie week like, and where were you assigned?
So I started out my career in the 114 precinct, which is in Astoria, Queens. And at that time, Steinway Street, which was a business district, a lot of commercial establishments there, they would put us rookie cops on a foot post just to make sure we were able to safeguard or secure any crimes that were going on in that business district.
Memorable incident from your rookie year? The most memorable.
Okay. So I eventually got had an opportunity to be put in a sector car, and I used to patrol a problematic development in Queensbridge. They had a lot of issues with
the Queensbridge?
Queensbridge, yeah.
Where Nas and
yes, sir, yes, sir,
a million rappers come out of Queensbridge.
Right. That's right.
Mobb Deep,
yeah. All those cats came from there. So, unfortunately, that night while we were patrolling that area, we got a radio run of an individual shot. So me and my partner responded to the job, and there was a Hispanic male that, if I recall, was on a bike, but the bike was to the side, and he was laying on the ground, and he had a bullet wound, if I recall, either his chest or maybe his head. So me and my partner tried to do CPR on him. We called for an ambulance right away. Ambulance got there as quickly as they could do. But he expired right in front of my eyes. And that was an eye-opener for me. That showed me that this is not something that I need to take lightly. This is a profession. And, you know, we have to make sure that we keep each other safe. We make sure we do the best we can to keep the community safe, because unfortunately there are some people out there that will hurt people. And we got to make sure anybody that looks to do that, we bring them to justice.
How did seeing someone die in front of you for the first time on the street affect you emotionally?
So it was difficult. It was nothing that the police academy taught you how to deal with. I am blessed that I had an opportunity to go home and talk to somebody that was in this line of work, which was my wife. I was able to tell her some stories and things that I might have gone through the day. It helped me. It helped me get things off my chest. And you know, sometimes it's half the battle, being able to talk to somebody. Mm-hmm. And who better to talk to than somebody that's in the same line of work? So,
You married a police officer.
I married a police officer. I met my wife in the police academy in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Three girls later, we're still doing our thing. That's why I'm follicly challenged now. You know,
I was about to say I've raised two daughters myself, and that's
so,
probably why I'm clean shaven head these days.
Yeah, yeah. If I grow my hair and I would look like George Jefferson, so I had to shave it all off. But my kids are great. They've been a great support in this journey, being part of this organization. You know, there are long days. Unfortunately, I've missed birthdays. I've missed holidays. I miss a lot of family events, mm-hmm. because I had to come to work, and they've been very understanding, very supportive. I think one of the things that has helped is my wife was in the same line of work that I was.
Now, for our audience who may not be familiar with Queensbridge, it is a huge public housing complex. It's almost like its own little city. And obviously, it's legendary in hip-hop circles for producing great rappers like Nas and Mobb Deep and so forth. Mm-hmm. But tell us what it's like to actually patrol in a community of that size. And at that time in the 90s, mm-hmm. there were a lot of bullets flying.
Yeah, yeah. So unfortunately, I want to eventually talk about how neighborhood policing has helped us. There was a disconnect. There was a lack of trust between the residents of Queensbridge and the police officers. One of the things that I took pride in is I like to get out the car, and we used to do what's called a park and walk and talk, and get out and talk to the residents. Just get to know people, exchange ideas, share information, and I think quite often that helped. Anytime there was a need for assistance, the new police officer Rodney Harrison because I took that initiative to going out and talking to people. So if there was an incident that came up, they knew about me. There was an intimacy. There was a relationship. And there was also a trust factor. So in my rookie days, I came out the gate making sure I could build that trust factor in the communities that I was there on a regular basis.
Now, you and I have both dealt with the stop snitching phenomenon, that whole culture of just don't tell the police. Somebody gets murdered, you saw it, but you're not going to say anything. Mm-hmm. How did that play into trying to police in Queensbridge, for example, trying to solve crimes, trying to find perpetrators of shootings, and running up against that culture? And what was the consequence to those who actually were willing to testify in a trial at a violent act?
Yeah. So people were very reluctant to talk to us. I think that's one of the reasons why at that time, back then, we had difficulty in solving a lot of the shooting incidents because, unfortunately, the prosecutors need something to collaborate the information to prosecute somebody. So getting a witness to come forward was difficult, and for the reason being that there's a chance of retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's real.
And it is what it is. And that's in all lines of work. People are always going to be reluctant to give up somebody else. You got to think about it for 1 second. If you're a resident of a certain area and you're now going to court to testify against a gangbanger or a drug dealer, this and the other, but then you have to go back to the same residence or the same block or the same area where you reside and see the friends of this individual, you're putting yourself in jeopardy. We have to find a way to get people to trust us, get people to understand that we'll protect you if you come forward. There's ways of giving information where your amenity is protected. So there's a lot of different things that we're doing now in the NYPD that are helping and strengthening those relationships so people could come forward.
We paused the show to tell you about a sponsor of ours, Hubble Contacts. How you see the world means everything, and that's especially true if you wear contact lenses. Your contacts don't just impact your vision, they affect your comfort and eye health too. Contact lenses have been way overpriced until Hubble. Visit HubbleContacts.com. You'll get 2 weeks of daily lenses shipped straight to your door for just $1. Don't forget to select our show, PD Stories, in the post-checkout survey. One of our A&E producers tried the contacts and was excited to see how affordable they were for such good quality. 2 weeks of lenses for just $1, and you can start a monthly prescription with no stress or hassle. He also found they had great customer service and made the process really smooth. And you don't even need a prescription. If you are a person that likes to wear fresh contact lenses daily, you don't have to look any farther. Want daily contacts at a price you can afford? Visit HubbleContacts.com. You'll get 2 weeks of daily lenses shipped straight to your door for just $1. That's 30 contacts for just $1 at HubbleContacts.com. And don't forget to select our show, PD Stories, in the post-checkout survey.
From the network that brought you the Cold Case Files podcast comes I Survived, the classic stories you know, with new interviews, updating each woman's story with everything that happens after survival.
I survived because I convinced him that I was a person.
I survived because I was a smarter person than my assailant.
I survived because I believe God saved me.
Surviving is just the beginning of their story. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
You talked about starting out your career on foot patrol. I did foot patrol in D.C., and it is different than riding around in a car.
Yeah.
A lot of cities don't even have foot patrol police officers. Mm-hmm. Everybody's in a car, and so they don't really get to interact with people on a personal face-to-face basis until they hit the blue lights and pull somebody over.
Right.
When you were out there on foot patrol, what were some of the things that people came to you and expressed to you were important to them as you being the guy patrolling their street?
So, unfortunately, once again, it depends on what block or what post I was on. But if you don't mind, I'll just go back to like a Steinway Street.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to deal with the different businesses. And sometimes they would have a problem with a customer or they would have a person that were, that they knew that would come in, be looking to take things. So we had to, always had to have that constant relationship and constant awareness. And we also, I used to make sure things that we learned in our training, crime prevention tips, I would share with them. Hey, listen, be careful if somebody asks for this, or make sure you know about counterfeit money, or hey, listen, people are snatching cell phones, or when you go to an ATM machine, make sure you're aware of your surroundings. So one of the best things you could do in law enforcement is communicate, talk to one another, share each other's concerns and ideas. And it was great having the business owners or the business workers come talk to me about things that they observed, as well as, you know, me sharing information with them regarding, hey, somebody might have been wanted for a robbery around the block, or, you know, just making sure that we shared information. And, you know, when people are comfortable with police officers, believe it or not, they'll be willing to come forward and give you information as well.
Did you ever have anyone disrespect you because you were an African-American police officer simply because you were black? Did you ever have anyone just disrespect you because of that?
Absolutely. I'm a sellout. I've been called an Uncle Tom. I've been called all types of different names. You know, I don't know if you remember, KRS-One had that song, Black Cop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been, people walk past me singing that song. But, you know, police officers, we have to have thick skin. If you come on this job and you are unable to take scrutiny from the public, it's going to be a long day at work. So I'd never let that bother me. I know who I am.
What's the most hairy situation you ever found yourself in on the street?
So after I did patrol in the 114, I always had aspirations of being an undercover. So in 1994, I was assigned to Brooklyn North as an undercover. And one night in September, there was a major problem in shooting incidents in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
So our captain asked us, my module was a couple undercovers and investigators. He said, hey, listen, we're going to change our hours. There's a lot of shooting incidents going on in Bed-Stuy on the midnights. We got to work at midnight and do some buy and bust operations here. So, you know, I had some go-getters, some great workers on my team back then. So we went out there, and I was undercover. I tried to purchase at one of the corners. The individual didn't know who I was. So
just a cold hand-to-hand, just walking up to people selling drugs?
Yeah, we know they're selling drugs. So I walked up to the individual. He didn't know who I was, so the transaction never went down. So my partner was out there also, and this individual got raised up, and for some reason he must have thought it was a robbery or something like that, and he just started screaming at my partner.
What do you mean raised up?
He saw me continue to walk down, and my partner, who's watching me, following in the same direction I was going to. So I walked back, and my partner was following me, and the individual pulled out a gun and started shooting at my partner, and shot him one time in the arm and went through his arm and into his chest. I then pulled out my gun, started firing at the individual, and that me and him are shooting at each other. He drops his gun. While my partner's on the ground after being shot, he pulls out his gun and he starts shooting the individual too. So we're both shooting at this drug dealer. He takes off fleeing. I give chase. And we're able to capture him shortly afterwards. So that was probably one of the scariest moments in my life. My partner is no longer on the job.
Because of that gunshot?
Because of the gunshot wound. He's doing fine. He's able to have his family, and he's living very well down in Virginia. But it was a very scary moment in my life, especially seeing your partner shot, especially when he tells you that he's having trouble breathing. And was a night that I'll never forget.
I just have to ask you, most cops will never be in a shootout in their career, even if they have a 20 or 30 year career. Most will not.
Most will not. I agree.
When it happened, as you think back on it, when it all just jumped off and the bullets started flying and you had to return fire, Did it seem to slow down to you? I've heard some people I've talked to in shootouts say everything slowed down. Some people say everything became like a tunnel vision. Do you recall what the sensations you were experiencing as you had to suddenly draw your weapon and return fire?
So you're absolutely right. Everything seemed to be slow. There was nothing but tunnel vision. I didn't see anything around me. I was just narrowing in on the shooter. I recall his muzzle flashing as he's shooting at me. So unfortunately, tactically, I could have done a better job. I started charging him instead of taking cover. Thank God.
You charged at him while firing.
I charged at him while I was firing. I should have done it. I should have taken cover. But once again, we make mistakes because it's a split second and the adrenaline is rushing and you're just trying to save your, I was trying to save my partner at the end of the day.
Well, that's quite a story.
Yeah.
And everybody comes when that call goes out. Every officer any distance is converging.
I can never, ever forget and thank the field team of officers that was working at night that were able to get my partner, Michael Stoney. I want to give him a shout out. How they were able to get into the hospital in an expeditious manner. I think that was very instrumental in his life being saved, and then how we were able to apprehend the suspect and the work by the Brooklyn DA's office, making sure we were able to put this guy away for a long time.
Now, have there been other times other than that shootout you were in where your partner got shot where you had to fire your weapon or almost had to fire your weapon? Any particular incident come to mind?
Yeah, so if I could go back to my time in Brownsville, I was an anti-crime officer. And we got waved down by a young lady that there's an individual inside this apartment building that has a gun. So me and my partners ran into the building. And as soon as we ran in, there was an individual at the top of the steps. And he was holding a hostage around in like a headlock. And he had pointed the gun down the steps at me and my team.
How close are you to him?
He's probably about 12 steps up. Maybe 12 to 15 steps up at the time. It was probably like a 60-degree angle up.
And you have no cover?
I have no cover. So he pulls the trigger on the gun, and the gun jams. So then he runs up another flight of stairs. We end up chasing him, and we end up recovering the gun. And we took a look at the gun and the bullet, and the firing pin hit the bullet. And for whatever reason, by the grace of God,
It didn't fire.
So, scary moment. My guardian angel was on my side that day. But this is a very dangerous job, and in order for you to do this line of work, you got to want to help people. You got to be courageous. But there are some dangers that come along with it. And, there's been a couple incidents where I look back where I was lucky to go home.
I know in D.C. on New Year's Eve, people just come out in certain neighborhoods and just start firing guns in the air. Do they do that in New York City, too?
I haven't seen that as of late, but my time back on patrol, there was recreational fire. New Year's would come around and people would take their guns out and stand on certain rooftops or go to a certain park and let off and fire their weapons. And one of the things that we in the NYPD, we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where we're getting into a shootout with somebody. So, we do kind of take a tactical stance in those instances. And then once the shooting ceases, we then move in and see if we can make an arrest afterwards.
Now, you've had some teenagers and young people caught in gang crossfires this year.
Yeah.
Just some really heartbreaking, tragic losses. Talk about that if you can.
So, yeah.
I think one was in Jamaica, Queens.
One is in Jamaica, Queens, Amir Griffin. He was over by a basketball court and some individuals that are from a rival gang. And he wasn't in a gang, actually, but there was some other rival gang members in the basketball court. And they pulled out their gun, and they were probably about 60 to 70 yards away and just started shooting in the park. And unfortunately, Amir, who was playing basketball, was shot in the neck and succumbed to his injuries. One of the struggles that we're faced with is this youth-on-youth violence. These young gang members just going back and forth, shooting at one another. And what we're seeing as of late, unfortunately, is innocent people being struck. There's a strategy in place, and the strategy is we, the police department, have to make sure we're working with the community to interdict some of this gang violence, to get these kids not to join the gangs. Like, what are we doing to get them off the streets? Well, can we get them in some type of community center? Can we teach them a trade or give them a job? It takes everybody to be hands-on to get involved with these concerns. And, unfortunately, the individuals that have been doing this shooting, a lot of them are out right now.
I mean, violent repeat offenders
who are out in the streets right now. The violence is continuing. So it's a work in progress. And I will say this, we do have great relationships with our law enforcement partners. We do have great relationships with our prosecutors, but everybody has to understand that everybody can't get a pass. Sometimes people need to deal with the circumstances of the crime that they might have committed. And, it's just been a problem, and not just in Queens. We've seen it in all of our boroughs.
We're going to pause the program for a moment to tell you about a sponsor of our show. Coloring your hair has been around for a long time, and it truly is an art and a science. But it's also not the easiest thing to get done, because the options available to color your hair have been slim pickings. Either you go to a traditional salon and spend lots of time and money, or grab a box of hair color at the drugstore, which can be hit or miss. But now there's a new way. Madison Reed. It took a strong woman to shake up the hair coloring world, and Amy Errett did just that with Madison Reed, the company she named after her daughter. PD Stories listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit. Visit madison-reed.com. Use code PDSTORIES. And if you're thinking, okay, but how do I match my hair color? Don't worry. Madison Reed gives you the tools you need so you can color with confidence. Get ammonia-free, multidimensional hair color delivered to your door starting at $22. Visit madison-reed.com. That's madison-reed.com. And now, PD Stories listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit. Use code PDSTORIES. That's code PDSTORIES.
I'm not saying that necessarily people should have the key thrown away on every single murder, you know, no parole. But at the same time, a lot of the people we're talking about that are causing problems in those problematic precincts,
correct,
that you and your crime analysts analyze and address.
Well, I want people that are about reforming. Listen, I'm not going to sit here and say I'm for it or against it.
Mm-hmm.
But I want people to think that there's a victim on the other end. And this victim, who was the victim of a robbery, a victim of maybe being shot or an assault or whatever the case may be, even maybe a property crime. Now they have to see this individual if we choose to allow him out. And that could be traumatic in itself. I think it's a smack in the face in some of these victims when somebody gets a slap on the wrist and is allowed back out after they violated somebody's personal space. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating.
One of the things that we've been talking about on PD Stories this season is mental health for police officers. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely at the forefront now, I know, in NYPD. Mm-hmm. This year has been a particularly tragic one for NYPD, and you as the chief, you have to attend the funerals of officers who commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we headed right now, mm-hmm, in the focus on this? And what can the community do to help officers cope better with their mental health?
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of different strategies in place. And one of the things that we have to do, and we've been implementing this, is making sure that people know how to get help. We've been promoting it through the precinct level. We've been assigning a mental health task force to go to the different precincts, introduce themselves so people at the precinct level get to know who these people are, just in case if they need some type of assistance. And it's unfortunate because these suicides are unpredictable. They're not one of the same. But we got to keep fighting. And I think at the end of the day, and one of the things that I speak to my frontline supervisors about is you have to know your cops. And if your officer is going through a very difficult time, be it a marital problem, be it financial, be it somebody in the family is going through a health issue, you have to make sure you, as a frontline supervisor, get that person some help. That's how it goes, but it goes with knowing your personnel. And I think once we do that, once the supervisors as well as the other cops are all hands on deck, keeping an eye on one another, I think we'll be headed in the right direction.
Now, I see on your uniform there, you have one badge on top that says WTC. Is that World Trade Center?
Yes, sir.
Where were you on that day? And if you can, tell us about your experience with the 9/11 attack.
2001, on 9/11, I was assigned to the 7-3 precinct
in
Brownsville, Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I want to say at the time I was the burglary sergeant. And I remember I was in the office and somebody told me to turn the TV on to something that's going on in Manhattan. And there's a fire in one of the buildings. And we weren't sure what it was at first. And then there was another explosion in the other building. And we're like, what's going on? We couldn't figure it out. And I remember, like it was yesterday, one of the sergeants there said, I just saw something fly into the other building. And we're like, that's crazy. Like, why would a plane fly into a building? And then one of the buildings went down. And we had the radio on our citywide channel. And it was a pretty scary experience hearing your brothers and sisters in blue screaming for their life, coughing, asking for help, looking for assistance. And when you are helpless and there's nothing you could do because you're not there, it was terrifying. I would go down and help with the rescue efforts, and we would try to, you know, move as many much material off these piles of rubbish, and you know, I was just seeing body after body, and it was a very dark moment for the for New York City and as well as NYPD.
There were so many people, first responders, that were down there for months, mm-hmm. working at that scene, yeah. recovering yeah. Bodies and body parts. From a mental health standpoint, were you deeply affected by it in any way? How did you cope with that?
So, one thing about the NYPD that I will say is we do a great job of supporting one another. We have a strong support group. We all have a common bond, and everybody knows at the end of the day, we have each other's back. So being able to go through these very difficult experiences where if somebody was struggling, we would find ways to get them help, find a way to get their mind off it. You know, whatever we had to do, we were there for one another. We weren't co-workers at the time. Mm-hmm. We became family. And we were there for, you know, 18-hour days. We never went home. You know, people from the communities would bring food to the precincts so we could, you know, continue to do what we had to do to get through this very difficult time. It was tough. But the one thing that NYPD do that we do very well is we support each other through very, very difficult times.
How long have you been chief of police of the NYPD?
So it's going to be 2 years in January. And prior to that, I was the executive officer of the chief of patrol under, I could call him my mentor, Terrence Monahan. He's the one who brought me over to be his executive officer. I've been with him to watch the implementation of neighborhood policing. He asked me to oversee it throughout the city to make sure it's being done correctly, and it's been a blessing ever since.
What are the key components of NYPD's neighborhood policing strategy?
Okay, so I got to take you before 2015. One of the things that we would do is as a police officer, if you just when you come to roll call and you get your assignment on a Monday, you may be assigned to a certain area, and then the next day you may be assigned to a demonstration, and the next day you may be assigned to Yankee Stadium detail, and you never were assigned in the same area every single day. Neighborhood policing is asking cops to be in the same area every single day. And in that concept, their job is to take ownership
of that neighborhood.
Of that neighborhood that they're there to serve. And to work with the residents, to work with the stakeholders, to work with the religious institutions, work with the educational facilities, and identify some of the issues that may be going on and how together can we resolve them. Before neighborhood policing, there was a disconnect between NYPD and the communities that we were here to serve. There really was. And we had to figure out a way how to build that bridge. We started neighborhood policing in 2015. We started in the Rockaways, in the 100 and the 101, and Washington Heights in the 3334, just to pilot it out, see how it was working, and it was paying off. The NCOs, a cop was building a relationship with the community. And then once we started doing that and we saw it was working there, we then piloted in some of our more problematic precincts, and it was working in those precincts as well. As well as the most important thing is we were developing relationships as well as keeping crime down, which is, you know,
the bottom line.
Which is the bottom line. And we saw so many positive results. We saw people talking about having a neighborhood coordination officer assigned to them, them being accessible, them being able to address any needs that come up within that area of concern. And it's really paying positive results to make this city safer and to make sure there's a connection with the NYPD and the residents of the city.
Tell me about the NCOs in that program and what they do.
So the neighborhood coordination officers are the quarterback of that sector that they're assigned to. They're the ones who are building those relationships with the stakeholders within that sector. They take the information, and they're the ones who figure out how they're going to resolve it and what community people they're going to work with, what agencies they're going to work with. So if I could just give you an example, if there's a homeless issue in a certain area, that NCO is going to take that information, and maybe work with homeless outreach. If there's a situation in a certain building that people are squatting in, they'll reach out to the Department of Buildings. They're the, I call them the Google cop of the sector, and their job is to make sure they take ownership, they identify the issues, and they handle them as quickly as possible. They're assigned to the sector every single day. They have their own meetings. We call them the builder block meetings. And they're asking people to come to these meetings, working with elected officials, and make sure that there's good conversation and dialogue to be able to receive as many complaints that are going on and what can they do to resolve them. Every single cop in the New York City Police Department has a job cell phone. Everybody has an email address. We've now stepped our game regarding the utilization of social media, where we're posting things on our Instagram account and Twitter, just to give people awareness of what's going on. Hey, listen, there's a crime prevention concern that you need to be aware about. Hey, there's an individual that we're looking for. Hey, there's great work by this officer. We're getting the information out real time to the residents, and that's helping to strengthen the relationships. And the NCOs are the ones that are really the forefront of this new developing of trend that we're doing in the NYPD.
And the supervisors don't go to those meetings. It's just the NCO officers, right?
It's just the NCOs. We don't want any supervisors there. And they're there just to develop those relationships. And supervise. The reason why we don't want any supervisors there, because then the community will go to the supervisors. We want them to have that relationship with the neighborhood coordination officers. They have these meetings once every 3 months. But it's also incumbent that the NCOs also have meetings outside the builder block meeting. So if they have to go to a tenant meeting and talk to them, then they'll do that. So if they have, there's a block meeting somewhere, they'll go to that. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be once every 3 months. They could also do other meetings. But the builder block meeting is a great way for people to get to know who they are. And one of my ultimate goals or dreams is to make sure that every New York City resident knows that they have a cop assigned to them. And all they have to do is go on this website, buildablock.nyc, mm-hmm. put in their address, and what will pop up is your cop's information, how to get in contact with them, and when's the date with the next Build a Block meeting. So we're very big into transparency. We want people to be able to get in contact with that neighborhood coordination officer and make sure any concerns that they may have get addressed by these officers.
Chief, the NCO program, Build a Block, where would you like to see them 10 years from now?
So if I can take a magic wand and wave it, I would like for every single New Yorker to know that there's a cop assigned to them. I would like them to know that, hey, they know who their NCO is, and the NCOs know a lot more about the communities that they're there to serve. Once again, we've only been 4 years into it. I think there's still a lot of people that are unfamiliar with neighborhood policing and that they have a cop assigned to them, and they don't know about it. And I want to make sure in 10 years, everybody should at least know, I need to know who my NCO is just in case if I ever need them. I don't want them waiting till something arises and then they try to reach out to them. That relationship should be built beforehand.
What's your perspective on how training has evolved over these years since 1992 when you came on the force to where we are now? And what's your perspective on the evolution of training?
So training in NYPD has gotten 100 times better. I mean, we've learned from our mistakes. Anytime there's something that might have gone wrong or in the wrong direction, we evaluate, we analyze. We have a training bureau that really takes a look at a lot of the different incidents that go through the everyday boots to the ground police officer and make sure we share that experience with the rest of the police officers. So one of my favorite trainings is the CIT training, which I think has been absolutely phenomenal regarding how we're able to deal with emotionally disturbed people.
And CIT stands for?
Crisis Intervention Training. And, unfortunately, a routine job where we have to do with somebody that may be mentally ill can go wrong very, very quickly. And giving our police officers that crisis intervention training, being able to slow the situation down, be able to talk to the individual, being able to explain to them that we're here to get them help, I think has stopped a lot of situations from going wrong.
And a lot of this de-escalation training has really just started to become part of police training in the last maybe 3, 4, 5 years.
That's one of the trainings that we've implemented. But there's a host of other trainings that we have. We have implicit bias training where we, before we engage somebody, we're not taking a look at the exterior and not coming up with our own conclusions about somebody. That's another training that I think has been very, very important in our success in NYPD. Technology, we've jumped leaps and bounds in regard to technology and how we're providing all the police officers with cell phones and laptops inside the radio motor patrol vehicles, just so the cops could be smarter when they're responding to these calls for help. I think there's so many things that we've done to make our cops safer, make sure that at the end of the day, our police officers are having the opportunity to go home.
Do you just randomly ever drop into a roll call at a precinct? Hmm. Just show up out of the blue?
I don't like to show up out of the blue. I will let them know that I'm coming, but I think it's very important that me in this position, and I have 17,000 people under my bureau. They know who I am, and they hear my message. And I'm a big advocate of having each other's back. I love this job, but don't put it in front of your family. And make sure at the end of the day you get home safely.
Explain to our audience what roll call is for. I know what it's for, but a lot of people listening don't know the importance of roll call in the daily life of police officers.
Yeah, so one of our frontline supervisors, more than likely, it'll probably be our sergeants, could be our lieutenants, will have a roll call, and there's three different roll calls. There's one for the day tour, which is around 7:15. There's one on the 4 to 12, which is going to probably be around 3:15. Mm-hmm. And the last one would be on the midnight, which is about 11:15 p.m. And during this roll call, the sergeant just makes sure everybody's in attendance and give them their assignment. So they'll sit here and say, Harrison, Jackson, you're going to be assigned to a certain sector. This is what time your meal will be. These are the issues that are going on. And then they'll go on to the next sector and make sure that that sector knows what they're covering and so on and so forth. So it's what we do to make sure our cops are safe.
What do you think is the most important characteristic and thing about being a police officer? If you had to narrow down what makes a good cop, mm-hmm. what makes a good NYPD cop, yeah. or just a cop anywhere in the country, mm-hmm. what would be the one premium characteristic?
Well, the number one is you got to have courage.
Mm-hmm.
You got to want to be able to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be passionate. Those are the three things that I would say will make you a successful police officer. This is not an easy job. It's not an easy line of work. It's not for everybody. But I will say this. Because I'm in this situation, I see on a day-to-day basis, I see all the incidents that are going on throughout the city. Our police officers in New York are unbelievable. And I shouldn't be biased. It's all law enforcement throughout the country, I salute them because it's a difficult job. Unfortunately, sometimes you don't get the praises that they deserve. If you have one officer that may not represent us well, unfortunately, people, the public may paint us all with a broad brush, which I think is very unfair. I would sit here and say 99% of our officers are out there saving lives and keeping people safe. And it's something that sometimes is taken granted for.
You know, I've always said that in every profession, most of the people are in the right profession.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is in police work, if you're in the wrong profession and you're not the right person, that you have the ability to take someone's freedom, mm-hmm. take someone's life.
Yeah.
And as chief, I know that you have to deal with weeding out
yeah.
those ones that shouldn't be.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a tough decision. You know, officers sometimes make mistakes. They make bad decisions. But one thing we do not stand for is corruption. If there's an officer that is thinking about or doing something that they're not supposed to be doing, we will take them off the streets, and we will take them off this job. Because in order for us to have trust, we can't have corrupt cops.
What is a day in the life of chief? I mean, yeah. It's almost like it's got to be hectic, right?
Well, right, and before I say it, the part about it being hectic, I will also say that I am extremely, extremely blessed because being the chief of patrol of, and I'm going to be biased here, I think the greatest police department in the country, I would be selfish to sit here and say I'm extremely grateful to be here today, see some of the great work that's being done from my window is it's an eye-opener. You know, these cops are out there putting their lives on the line every single day, saving people. There's nothing better. But on a day-to-day basis, you know, it could be anything from going to memorials, to ceremonies, to things of that nature, to coming in and just analyzing some of the crimes that are going on throughout the city.
In the data.
In the data and just taking a look at, you know, where there's trouble going on, where there's a spike in crimes and what resources can I provide to that area to make sure that they handle that situation accordingly. It's a lot. It's long days, but I have a great team around me. I have some phenomenal patrol borough commanders. There's eight of them throughout the city. And we all have the same synergy, which is, you know, what are we going to do to make sure we make sure our cops get home at the end of the day? And what are we going to do to make sure the city stays safe? And it's really some phenomenal work that's being done.
Chief, as head of this police department in New York City, you also interact with police departments all over the world and you've traveled around the world.
Yeah.
What have you learned from those experiences seeing policing in other countries as it compares to policing in New York City?
Yeah, so I've had an opportunity to go to Jamaica. I recently went to Colombia, Bogota, Colombia. I met with their police department, their executives, and I just came back from South Korea. And it's absolutely fascinating how, you know, as great as the NYPD is, we could still learn from these other countries regarding how they fight crime, how they deal with the community. You know, these other countries are national police departments, so it's definitely a little different. But there's a lot of things in common we have regarding how we use technology, how we deal with the media, you know, how our, you know, uniform appearance, a lot of, you know, how we use
tactics,
things of that nature. So it's been good. I've had an opportunity to talk about neighborhood policing and what we're doing here in New York City and how it's paying off dividends and making things better and how it's doing two things, which is very important, which is keep crime down, but yet at the same time, build those relationships. So people are fascinated by what we're doing here. And quite often, not only just me going to the different countries, people quite often are coming down to MPP from out of the U.S. just to hear what we're doing. And I have an opportunity to meet with all different types of countries and tell them how this neighborhood policing is working here in New York.
Chief, do you ever get a day off?
What's that?
That'd be a no. I kind of thought to myself, this man probably has some work intruding into every day of his life, one way or another. Well, you love what you're doing.
I love what I do. But one thing that I will say is I've had all three of my daughters play sports. Mm-hmm. I try to make sure I make as many of their sporting events as possible. If I have to go to a game and then come back to work, then so be it. But I always impress to the cops, make sure you spend time with your family, because before you blink, they grow up fast, man. So it's important that you don't put this job in front of your family.
Chief, thank you. Thank you for being on PD Stories.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
My guest today has been Chief Rodney Harrison of the NYPD. It's been a pleasure. And it's been a brilliant insight into policing in this city. I'm just so honored that you came to talk to us here on PD Stories and to break it down for us as to what it's like being chief of this amazing city, Big Apple.
It's my pleasure, and I just want to salute all the men and women of the NYPD for the great work that they're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.